Morning, everyone.
Morning.
You look surprised. Anyway, it's nice to be here with all of you. And I decided today to give a talk about ritual because it's something that's, shall we say, near and dear to my heart. It's always been a bit of a challenge for me. I don't know if I've ever heard anyone who said, oh, I want to come to a Zen center so that I can practice ritual. They have such great rituals, all that bowing and chanting. I just love it. I usually hear, oh, I want to come to a Zen center so I can practice meditation and sit and get really calm and you know, really chill out. So I guess I fall into that camp. You know, I came to it wasn't Mountain Rain at the time, it was Karuna Meditation Society, and I thought, oh yeah, I want to sit with a group of people, you know, and I want to really settle my mind and basically become a better person. And then the ritual, felt like something extra to me. So I don't think that's unusual in our culture. I think, you know, we're a pretty independent lot and fairly iconoclastic. You know, we feel a little bit cautious about authority. We're not always, I don't know, is this leader going to do the right thing? Or and we're all hardcore individualists here, unlike some of the cultures that ritual and Buddhism has come from, which are more collectively oriented, more socially kind of cohesive. So that's my confession. It's not what you'd expect to hear from a Zen priest, but hey, I just ordained last November, so. But I decided to ordain in part because I felt such deep gratitude to this ancient tradition. It's one that has been carried through the ages by the rituals that actually form the framework for this practice. So I often envision it as kind of like a little cart. You know, here's the framework of the rituals, and they're carrying all of this wisdom along with them. But the monotone chanting, often in a language that's unknown to me, we'll do one later, the bells, the bowing, the incense, the altar, all of that made me wonder what we were doing here. But I just kept following along because I liked meditating with other people. I liked listening to Dharma talks. I liked reading. And I especially liked interacting with all of the other nice people in the group. I carry a lot of baggage related to ritual. Part of it relates to our cultural context. Part of it relates to my caring a lot about what other people think of me. This is an ongoing insecurity that I work with. And what would they think about me if they saw me engaging in all the weird bowing and chanting, you know, very foreign. The other part of this baggage comes from how I've experienced ritual in the past. In other traditions, I'd experienced ritual as an embodiment of religious dogma, stricture, and unwilling submission. So I looked up the definition of religion in the Oxford English Dictionary, and it said, the belief in a superhuman controlling power, especially in a personal god or gods, entitled to obedience and worship. So unfortunately, that was a big part of how I'd experienced the Lutheran religion that I grew up in. Fortunately, it wasn't all of how I experienced it, but it was enough to make me aware of my feeling of discomfort with the impositions of power. Then there was the hollow feeling that I got when I participated and watched ritual. There was sort of a theatricality to it, and there continues to be a theatricality even in the Zen tradition. But especially there, you know, there was pomp and circumstance, parading and performance. And unfortunately, yeah, it just continued to feel a bit hollow. But over years of practice, it's become clear to me that Zen is not the same thing that the OED defined as religion. So that was incredibly reassuring. I thought I'd reconciled my uncomfortable feelings about ritual. I even appreciated and learned much from the rituals. It was after I ordained and joined the winter practice period at Tassajara Zen Monastery last winter that the old feelings of discomfort came rushing up like a geyser. It was now my job, as a priest, to carry on these rituals and traditions, and I didn't feel totally on board with that. What had I done? It was really kind of alarming. So I had to begin exploring this feeling, and fortunately my time at Tassajara provided the opportunity to do that. This response was probably the only one I could have without leaving the monastery's practice period and giving my robe back to my teacher. I was able to actually lean on my ordination commitment to keep me facing the question rather than running away from it. After all, one of my commitments in becoming a priest was to not turn away. With a faith that had come out of what was a deeply nourishing practice for me, I knew it was the way to go, despite the discomfort. So I delved into it during my regular reading and study periods at the monastery, in discussions with other practitioners, and in observing my own reactions to participating in the numerous daily, weekly, and monthly services that punctuated our Zazen. And incidentally, during this particular practice period, we weren't given much explanation as to the meaning of various rituals. So it was really, you know, something that somebody wasn't going to hand me the answer to. So I thought I'd share with you some of what I discovered from my study and experience of ritual. Some of it describes the history of ritual in Zen, then a bit about the anthropology and psychology of ritual, and finally about my own conclusions on ritual, the topic of ritual. First off, a little of the history. Zen's roots are in both the traditions of Indian Buddhism and also in Confucian China. Confucianism is a cultural legacy that has permeated much of China's cultural and social order. The Tao, or the way, was a reflection of the patterns of heaven, an ultimate expression of the ancient sage kings. Ritual was not intended to praise the gods, but was for humans to understand and correct their uncultivated original nature. The idea was that the repetition and discipline involved in ritual would lead to its being internalized. It would thus act as an external constraint on natural desires and on uncultivated habits. And ultimately, it was intended to alter how humans understood themselves and how they lived in the world with each other. There was no sense that ritual was there to provide appreciation for a god or to ask the god for anything. It was about harmonizing with the great heavenly pattern. It was and is about balance and harmony and measure. So the purpose of participating in ritual was to bring human hearts into harmony with the cosmic order, because we have a part of ourself that gets out of balance. We need to participate in ritual to keep that part of ourselves in harmony with everything. So this Confucian tradition dovetails very well with our Zen practice and beliefs. This idea that the secular world, where we participate in ritual, and the ritual world, which is patterned after the heavens, are a continuum that blends with our concept that samsara and nirvana are one and the same, rather than two separate worlds. this relationship between the internalized action of ritual and its expression in society has also been recognized by modern scholars of all types. The French 19th to 20th century sociologist Emile Durkheim argued that this was the role of ritual generally, not just Confucian ritual. He said that when humans participate in ritual, it shapes them into subjects who not only think certain thoughts, but also perceive the world and understand themselves through the patterns impressed upon them by the repeated action of ritual upon their body and mind. And this has later been borne out in actual neurological studies of our limbic systems and our sensory experience. This aspect of ritual in shaping who we are makes some sense, though. I think we can understand it because we all experience this type of repetition in many aspects of our life. What we do repeatedly shapes us and what we're aware of. So we get up and we go to work. We come home, cook our dinner, we garden, we play, we engage in creative work. And it becomes clear through time that what we repeatedly do, how we repeatedly think or feel, is what we are and will likely become more of. Buddhist academics, such as Paula Arai and Tigan Dan Leighton, would describe the performative function of ritual. And much of this was in a book I studied called Zen Ritual, Studies of Buddhist Theory and Practice. In it, they state that Zen rituals are about postures, gestures, and patterns of movement. To make sense of this basic dimension of Zen, we need to engage its fundamental corporeality by understanding Zen as a specifically embodied practice. That's pretty academic. In other words, ritual is about practicing with the body and not just the mind. That's what I take away from that. And in fact, the entwined nature of the body and mind means that they are not separate, but they are deeply unified. So ritual isn't simply some way that you express your beliefs or values, but in using your body, voice, and mind, it becomes something that actively changes you. You're imagining and visualizing yourself in a particular way. Stepping inside the ritual space during service, you become a Buddha. You become an elevated person in the same body. So a bit more about the history. So what shaped the ritual you practice with today? Certainly it was the Indian Buddhist traditions and the Chinese Confucian legacy, but it also came from the way our Soto Zen ancestor, Ehe Dogen, interpreted and transmitted ritual in his monastery and through his writings. His Ehe Shingi and Ben Doho provided and still provide instructions for monks' conduct at Eheji Monastery, with instructions that are extremely detailed and complex. So it includes everything from how to wash your face to the method in which you use the toilet, and of course the way in which you get dressed, put on your robes, etc. Part of this was to allow dozens or even hundreds of monk trainees to coexist in a limited space with limited resources. But the other part was to provide training in mindfulness and paying attention to both the task and the body, a sort of meditation with the body. In becoming familiar with the rituals, monks begin to learn the patterns of life in the monastery, and there's less need to trouble the mind with what to do next. Mental space is freed up and silence can enter. So it may not feel like it when you first join Mountain Rain or join a retreat. You kind of look around and see that all these people are doing all these things and you're worried about, oh, am I doing this in the right order? Am I bowing at the right time? Oh no, I screwed up. Somebody's doing it differently. And so it makes us feel uncomfortable. But eventually, when you learn it, when you become comfortable with it, it just becomes part of a dance. part of a choreography that we flow through, where we don't really have to think about what's going to happen next because we know. We don't have to make a decision about it. Dogen considered Zazen the core ritual, so Zazen, our sitting practice, but it was still simply one of many ritual activities in everyday life. In his early 1231 writing on the meaning of meditation in Bendoa, or the wholehearted engagement of the way, Dogen emphasized that the meaning of the teachings is actually expressed in external, actualized practice, and not simply some attainment of deep states of meditation, great understanding, or the ability to simply theorize on the teachings of Buddhism. These externalized expressions include the rituals of service, chanting, bowing, walking, eating, and every aspect of life. One surprising thing I learned about Dogen's role in the transmission of Zen ritual is that his teachings were actually lost, or at least greatly diminished in importance, for a long time, like hundreds of years. Some Zen teachers would read Dogen, but would rarely lecture on him. It was only with the rise and growing predominance of the Obaku Zen sect, which is a type of Rinzai Zen, known for its discipline and scholarly study, that the Soto Zen establishment began to revive studies of ritual. And this was really important for the Soto Zen sect, because without the respect of society and the state, they would lose funding, they would lose members, and eventually their temples would decline. Many rituals today actually come out of this sort of resurrection of Dogen's ideas about ritual. And they're not always directly drawn from the Shobo Genzo or other writings by Dogen. They're kind of, some of them are kind of a mishmash, like, okay, here, I'll take some from this Indian tradition here and from a few words of Dogen there. So one interesting ritual that we practice today is Kinhin. That's our walking meditation. And it's not clear that that was actually a consistent practice in Zen monasteries until the 17th century, when this revival of Dogen Zen took place. And even in that, the teacher Menzan Zuiho drew from all of these different texts, and Kinhin actually looked sort of different. It was actually done in straight lines up and down a hall rather than around in a circle. So we may think that Zen ritual is kind of this immutable, you know, ancient, unchanged action, but it's not. And we change our rituals perhaps, you know, slowly, but they're often changed to suit the circumstances. But that still raises the question for me about why we still practice these ancient, or at least very old, rituals today. And what meaning can they have in our modern life? What is their relationship to what we believe we came here to practice for? I'd like to bring forward some ideas from a talk by my teacher, Norman Fisher, about ritual, and then add some further thoughts based on my own experience. Norman quotes from the Dictionary of the History of Ideas, where ritual is defined in the following way. Ritual is an imitative or symbolic action designed to achieve some end, often of a supernatural character, that could not be achieved through normal means. He goes on, so in other words, you've tried everything that you could think of, but nothing has worked. He says that one of the rules in ritual is to step outside of practical life and its ordinary forms of causality, where we feel, I can do this action, and then it will have this effect. Or, I can fix this. I have control over my life. Because how often is this not the case? I can tell you that during the recent record rains in Central California, actually that was not too recent, it was January, living in a monastery where I couldn't engage in my usual life roles, where I was fairly competent, I didn't feel much control at all. This can feel disconcerting as we live in a very secular age where science, rationalism, and I must add, consumer capitalism are the predominant worldviews and forces. After all, who needs ritual? Aren't we able to control everything, like remotely setting our thermostat with our smartphones when we're away from home? Everything is explainable, even the most mysterious things, even if we can't explain them at this time. One of the few universally endorsed ways of expressing ourselves is through the consumer marketplace, buying just the right things at just the right time. There's very little opportunity to simply experience the wonder of being alive without having to analyze it, explain it, or purchase it. Norman goes on to say that in recognizing the provisional nature or limited nature of our control over our life, in ritual we can release ourselves to something beyond our capacities. We step outside of this objective world. And this is why ritual is so foreign in our world today, where the objective world has increased its scope so much. In other times, the objective world was a lot smaller, and the unknown scary forces beyond the causal world were bigger. So ritual is actually a necessity for everyday human life. Maybe life would have been too stressful without it. Is that 20 minutes? Just want to be careful. So in performing ritual, we can step out of the space of our usual views. We can open our hearts to those things we actually don't control, like sickness, old age, and death. We can open ourselves and our awareness to the mystery and beauty of life. And so we begin our services by taking our places, standing quietly, fluffing our cushions, and standing in shashu. We bring our attention to our bodies and our breath, and we stand in a dignified, silent posture. We can take this as an opportunity to pause, to remember, and to simply feel the wonder of being alive. We can set aside our conditioned self and our various hang-ups and problems and simply engage in the ritual. We become part of a mandala. We become a Buddha among Buddhas. If you think about when we stand in the posture of service, it's also like organizing ourselves into a symbolic state of readiness. Readiness for whatever comes. We allow physical sensation and not just mental process to be the focus of our activities for a time. Because it is very physical. Think of bowing. So when we bow, yes, we're bowing to an altar and to a Buddha statue, but we're actually bowing to our own intention and capacity to recognize our Buddha nature. In the physical act of bowing, I sometimes have experienced a type of opening. There's trust required in allowing oneself to fall to the floor. It also feels like a sense of acceptance, and once again, ready for whatever happens. Maybe I make a nice, graceful bow. Or maybe it's kind of clumsy and I trip over my robes. Yeah, it happens. Sometimes people have described bowing as an expression of humility, but perhaps it can also be an expression of strength, that even when we fall, we still get back up. Of course, we can't forget that bowing is a powerful expression of gratitude. Gratitude for this improbable and rare life. And where else do we get to express that and to share that feeling with others? In a larger sense, though, enacting a ritual together, performing a service, there can be a wonderful feeling of harmony with others. The sounds of voices chanting, coming together, the bells being struck at just the right time. We feel close to the people with whom we are performing the service. We move together in the ritual space, and we experience a kind of intimacy that we didn't have before. We do this together, not just as isolated individuals, but as a unified body. Yes, like a mandala describing unity, each element of the mandala expressing its sound in chanting, its shape in bowing as the service proceeds. How different this is from the way we usually live our lives these days, where we rarely step out of our unquestioned story about what our life is. The rituals of service can provide the punctuation that actually changes the meaning of that story. Life becomes more than just the steady stream of our problems, the steady stream of maybe slightly boring, slightly dissociated social media posts. Ritual can also add meaning to the story by providing an opportunity to note and remember important moments, an acknowledgement that something out of the ordinary happened, such as a marriage, birth, death, or commitment to a path. I don't think that I've been completely released from my karmic baggage around ritual, but I feel like I've been able to open my heart to it. When I started preparing for this talk, I did some brainstorming, and I did this colorful picture with different colored pens with a ritual in the middle, and then just random thoughts and different colors all around that. When I picked that brainstorming piece of paper up a few weeks later, in preparation for writing, I was surprised to see that most of the associations were actually positive. So even though I don't think I've reached some conclusive state of peace with ritual, I feel like I've opened to my own experience of ritual. I approach it with a sense of questioning, like, how will I experience ritual today? How will I feel? What am I really doing here? And isn't that what our practice is about? Being present to what we think, feel, and do as we live our days and moments? Bringing compassionate awareness to what is, whether uncomfortable or delightful, and not turning away from the suffering of ourselves or others. Thank you very much. I don't think I've stopped it. How do you stop it? It's moving. Hit what once? No red button. There isn't a red button. I don't know.
Oh, that's why, because you're locked out.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So now we'll do a little ritual.